cities of the West Bank, the settlers are vaccinated, and nearby Palestinian cities and communities are not vaccinated. Not only they grab our land, not only they settle illegally on our land, take away our natural resources, take away our sources of economy, but also they practice this system of apartheid. I call it vaccination with racism.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, physician, member of the Palestinian Parliament, thanks for joining us.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB Stony Brook. It's time for Off the Wall.
So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
All right, we're going to start a little early since we started a little late. It's Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
A.K.A. Kyle.
Yeah, how about that? He spelled it differently the second time. That's why you might not have noticed.
How you doing?
Good. I don't know how he keeps getting in on all the programs. You might have heard him throughout the day. But it just basically... there he is again. This phone call, I swear, I'm hearing it everywhere. Wow. There's never been a phone call like this. Ever. Ever.
Yeah. It mixes well with that theme. I don't know how.
It mixes well with anything.
It's a certain trip.
Music of your choice, alcohol of your choice, this thing, it works. And the beauty of it is, it'll work 10 years from now as well. Oh my God.
That's pure Trump, the politician.
He couldn't sound any more corrupt than if you had given him a script from The Sopranos. basically threatening, pleading, haranguing. Yeah, definitely haranguing. Boy, you could not get this guy off the phone. Can you imagine having Trump on the phone and he can't get off the phone? Yeah, you listen to the whole thing, and it's all over the place. You listen to the whole thing, and you just hear the pain in those people's voices. It's the President of the United States. They want to get off the phone so badly, but they just can't. He's not getting any point that they're making. He's insisting that there is fraud when there has never been any evidence presented. I was watching CNN this morning, because it's fun to just turn on and see in these crazy days what's going on. And I saw one of the CNN anchors talking to a senator from Louisiana. And this senator just was towing the Trump line and not yielding anything, but not making any sense either. The CNN anchor kept asking, "So when are you going to show evidence of voter fraud?" And the senator kept saying, "I already showed you the evidence." And apparently he thinks by saying that there was fraud, that's the evidence. He said, "You come to my office and I'll show you thousands of pages of accusations." Basically, that's not how evidence works. And then he went on to say, he went on to say to the CNN anchor that, "You don't know how investigations work. I do. Just the other day, there was more evidence presented in the Lockerbie bombing." and that was 30 years ago. So, yeah, you don't get the evidence all at once. Big difference, though, and this is something the CNN anchor did not jump on. The big difference is you had a crashed airplane on the ground. That was evidence. That was evidence that something was wrong. There's no crashed airplane on the ground here. There's nothing here. Nothing at all. Except a lot of soreheads going around saying that this can't be. This is wrong. It doesn't make sense. We should have won. We didn't win. Something had to go wrong. It doesn't make... And basically just literally defying reality and calling that evidence. It's funny, but it's also scary because people believe what they are told by their leaders. And I feel terrible even calling them leaders, because they do not act like leaders. They act like spoiled children, and I'm sorry to all the spoiled children out there, because I honestly think you act better than this. They simply will not get it into their heads that something didn't go their way, that they're not getting what they want. And I love seeing it. Excuse me, I love seeing this happen. I love seeing them not get their way, but I worry about the price. You know, if this thing tomorrow, oh my God, Trump is organizing this this event, I guess you call it, March on Washington, demonstration, I don't know for what. This actually just got tweeted out moments ago. Join President Donald J. Trump at the Save America March, Wednesday, January 6, 2021. Oh, welcome to 2021, by the way. It's our first show. Washington, D.C., the Ellipse. Do you know what the Ellipse is?
No.
I don't either. Doors open at 7 a.m.
That's early.
So if you want to wait around for 4 hours at the Ellipse to see President Trump. Wait, when did I say it was 11 a.m.? I didn't say that, but how do I know that? How do I know that? It doesn't say that. Oh, it says it in the tweet above it. Okay, I will be speaking. Okay, this is Trump saying this. I will be speaking at the Save America Rally, all caps, tomorrow on the Ellipse at 11 a.m. Eastern. Arrive early, doors open at 7 a.m. Eastern. And again, big, all caps, big crowds. I just, you know, when he tweets, I just always like to see what the first reply was. And if I can read it over the air. Let's see. Glad the loser of honor will be speaking at the loser rally. Okay, I guess that's kind of clever. Here's another one. Treason's greetings. That's kind of cool. Please go down with the boat. The way you divided the American people is not God's love, and you shall reap, it is said. Okay, it goes on like that. Many, many thousands replies immediately. Oh, so yeah, that's happening tomorrow. Big, massive rally. It's, it basically worries me because...
The loser rally.
Well, yeah, you can call it that, but it's going to be a violent loser rally because these people are angry. These people are violent, you know, Proud Boys and all the assorted racists that come along with them. And just a lot of people that don't believe the virus is real, people who don't trust science, who hate the media, hate anyone who doesn't look like them, they're all going to be gathering, they're all going to be angry. And it's not just a rally, it's basically the same day that Congress votes to authorize or to accept the Electoral College. And, you know, I think the Electoral College is silly, but that's the system we have, and that's how it works.
It's not a coincidence, and Trump was saying today, or I think at his rally last night, talking about Mike Pence and trying, basically pressing him and putting the same kind of pressure on him around the overseeing that he will be doing, and mostly a symbolic capacity.
Uh-huh.
Because the process itself is laid out, and it's just basically formally acknowledging what the states have decided and certifying the whole thing, everything that's been already certified.
It's bureaucracy. It's paperwork.
But sending your thugs in a supposed expression of free speech on that under those circumstances. Seems a little bit, I don't know, dishonest or less than noble in your cause.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just fantasy land, and it's great. You know, it's great to believe in Santa Claus and things like that. But when you're talking about running a country, when you're talking about mobs of people. When you're talking about accusing others of all kinds of horrendous behavior when there simply is absolutely no evidence to support that, and you happen to be leading the most powerful country in the world, you're the leader, the most powerful person in the world, it's very troubling. And here's another tweet that he just sent, too. There's a limited amount of time we'll be able to read his tweets.
Live tweet, no.
Well, it does need to be focused on. You can say, let's ignore it. You can't ignore this. You can't ignore it. It's too troubling.
Well, let's try to keep it all.
Antifa is a terrorist organization. Stay out of Washington. Law enforcement is watching you very closely. Really? Oh, my God. The people to watch out for are the right-wing violent types who walk around armed and attacking people, killing people. And Antifa is not even a group. It's a concept. It's an idea. It's something, you know, we can say right now that we are part of Antifa. In fact, I'd proudly say I'm part of Antifa because I'm anti-fascist. And I do believe Nazis should be punched. I don't think that's really that. We did a lot of punching in World War II, and it was seen as a good thing. In fact, I'm even going to say, without fear of contradiction, that I am the assistant to the regional manager of the Northeast Division of Antifa. Yeah. So there you go. Refute that.
It's a pretty high rank. I mean, that probably took you a while to get. Well, I don't want to get into the bureaucracy, but that's.
I'm not the assistant regional man. I'm the assistant to the regional. Well, there's a difference. A fine difference.
I see it. It's on your jacket.
Yeah, I had those printed up, a lot of them. I'm not going to D.C. The reason I'm not going to D.C. is because of the virus, you know, and taking a train down there probably wouldn't be the wisest thing in the world. And I don't think it's much of a battle that needs to be fought in the streets. Because reality is not on their side. Let them live in fantasy land on their own. But when they do things like burn flags of Black Lives Matter outside black churches and engage in hate crimes like that, those have to be answered for. Absolutely. And one of the leaders of Proud Boys was, in fact, arrested because he admitted to doing that the last time they had a rally.
Yeah, I like what James Clyburn was saying. Specifically about the Georgia election, but he was saying show up and show them. And I think that speaks to the process. Like, there's still this vote and a institution that the majority of Americans, who I also would say are anti-fascist,
mm-hmm.
are waiting for the results and really counting on the real end of the voting period by the resolution of this.
Haven't even talked about Georgia, which is happening right now.
Yeah, and I just think that there are still mechanisms that voters and citizens can participate in. You know, there's a lot of doom and gloom around institutions and things failing everyday people, but people are a part of activating those institutions
mm-hmm.
and having a say. This very day, at this very moment, the waning hours of the Georgia election, is an important part of showing folks that won't even honor the institutions anymore.
Right.
Because they lost. That's a way to show them, because day in, day out, things are going to continue to operate. As they have in civil society. That's why it's important not to be egged on by, you know, someone who's wielding National Guard and all that kind of thing, and basically trying to have a reason to institute further authoritarian mechanisms. I think this is not quite the moment, especially the points you made, too, about keeping a distance and activism in a pandemic.
Well, you know, I've seen so many people that I'm proud of just watching the way that they have been mobilizing and speaking out and challenging in this whole process, not just for the Georgia senatorial runoff that's happening right now, but throughout these last 4 years. I've seen so many people really speak out and stand up for what they believe in, stand up for democracy. Sadly, I've seen a lot of people go the other way as well, and it's shocking to me, and I don't use that word often. It's shocking to see so many senators say that they're going to object to the results of the election tomorrow. You know, it's one thing when, as has happened in the past, when one congressperson does something symbolic and objects because they don't like the outcome, fine. But this is more than just a symbolic act. They actually want to overturn the election. They want to ignore the will of the people. They want to act in an undemocratic fashion. There is no disputing that. There is absolutely no disputing that. There is no evidence to support their position. They don't want the will of the people to be respected. Now, we've seen a number of senators do this. I understand a number of representatives will be doing it too. I don't know if Lee Zeldin is going to sign on. I'm pretty sure he will, our representative here in Suffolk County. And the moment he does that, he is an enemy of democracy because he is signing on to a coup, an attempted coup. How do you deal with people like that? How do you deal with elected representatives who don't respect the country that they are representing, who don't respect the Constitution? It's something we've never really had to face before. Certainly nobody who's alive has had to face this before. And it doesn't end. It doesn't end after tomorrow. It doesn't end after after the 20th. I just realized, you know, we had to step on the theme a little bit today because we had a late start. We only had one more week to play this theme before we switch over to the new administration. And then I realized, no, actually we have 2 weeks because the 20th is on a Wednesday. So 2 weeks from today, Trump will still be president. It's too damn long between elections and taking the office. It shouldn't be this long. November, December, January.
Yeah, I think it's made a lot of people a little nervous.
Well, you know, say what you will about Bill Maher, he got this right. He's been saying for the last 4 years, Trump will not leave if he loses. And he is proving that he won't. And I never could understand, you know, I know he generates a lot of controversy because of some of the things he says. He's racist in many ways. But still, he says a lot of good things, and you can't just condemn somebody completely for the bad things and not acknowledge the good things. Another example of that, de Blasio. Oh, my God. Everybody I know hates de Blasio. You know, liberals, conservatives. But the thing is, someone like him does a lot of good things. Yeah, you know, the biggest complaint I hear from liberals is that he kowtows to the police. The biggest complaint I hear from conservatives is that he insults the police. Well, it can't be both. Thing is, he takes tentative steps to challenge the police. The conservatives attack him. The liberals refuse to back him up for one reason or another. Well, what do you do if you're somewhat spineless? You basically gravitate towards the people who are yelling the loudest. And so you have only yourself to blame if he starts acting against your interest, if you didn't support him when he took a tentative step in that direction. This is something that we really need to learn how to get better at, is acknowledging people who get it mostly right, not totally right, or maybe even get it partially right. You know, I was saying the Secretary of State in Georgia and a bunch of Republicans down there are really doing a good job of standing up for democracy. I don't agree with their politics, but damn, I agree with how they're handling themselves. These are good people.
That's what I was.
You can't say that, though. You'll get attacked for saying that because they're Republicans. No, that's wrong. Acknowledge people when they do good things and criticize them when they do bad things, but don't ignore them. We have more friends than we think we have.
Yeah, you should have like a karmic tip jar for them in your mind.
That's a good idea. That's a very good
idea.
Because
they do have perspectives and can really teach you a lot about the truly craven of their tribe, or whatever, however you want to describe it.
So, yeah, you know, you heard the whole phone call?
No, I haven't listened to it in its entirety.
Oh, boy. It's something else.
I've been watching the fallout of this whole thing.
Can we play it one more time?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just got to hear it.
So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
You need a lot more than that, Donald. A lot more than 11. Do you notice that what he said, though? He needs 11,780 votes. 11780. That's the zip code of St. James. They're our neighbor. In fact, part of Stony Brook campus is in St. James. I mean, what are the odds of that? Come on. We've got the number, 11780. You know, another 10, it would have been 11790, which is Stony Brook.
What are the odds? That's, well, there's probably pretty...
And he said 11779 is how many they have. We want one more than that. But 11779 is Ronkonkoma. You know, I know a lot of zip codes. I just realized that. Huh. Anyway, that's, I thought, significant. But the other thing that I noticed the media, a lot of the media is not really focusing on. They're all playing the cleaned up version of that phone call. Why is nobody playing the way it actually sounded? Well, we at Off the Wall managed to snag a copy of the way the phone call really sounded.
Wait, whoa.
Take a listen.
Okay, thank you very much. Hello, Brad and Ryan and everybody. We appreciate the time and the call. So we've spent a lot of time on this, and if we could just go over some of the numbers, I think it's pretty clear that we won. We won very substantially.
Okay, we gotta leave it there. We only have an hour, but yeah, that's
by rally size, frankly.
That's Trump for you. That's our president. When you do this to the recording, it goes 90 minutes instead of 60 minutes, but it is so worth it.
Sounds like a lecture. I don't want to say any names, but we've all had those kind of professors.
I've never had a professor like that. I had a professor fall asleep in the middle of a lecture, his lecture, but I've never had anything quite like this, and I don't think I'd be able to tolerate it if I did. Yeah, so the election is happening right now. Basically, two senators are being selected in Georgia because of the way they run things. They had to have a runoff because no candidate got more than 50%. And so today, it's a rather unique situation. Today, both members of the Senate in Georgia are being selected by the people. And I was looking at CNN earlier. And they had a poll. They were showing a poll of voters asking Republican voters. And, you know, keep in mind, we don't know how this race is going to turn out. Asking Republican voters, how much faith do you have? Or how confident are you that this election will be run fairly? 50% said they had confidence. 48% said they had no confidence. They asked the same question of a random amount of Democratic voters, 96% said they thought it would be run fairly. 3% said unfairly. That speaks volumes right there. Without even knowing the result, who has faith in our electoral system? After having seen all the crap that we've been going through over the past however many weeks.
Well, just imagine if you have, like, the Trump app, or you're just inundated by your friends, social affinity groups, family, whatever, like, telling you all this crazy stuff is going on. I feel like there's a lot more of that going on than with Democrats on, like, a social level. So It doesn't really shock me, but that is a stark dichotomy or difference there.
Well, I mean, you have to wonder, if you really have no faith in the system, why bother voting? And I wonder how many people didn't bother voting because of that. But consider this, if Democrats lose, which is a distinct possibility, if they lose one or both seats and Republicans maintain control of the Senate, or I should say Mitch McConnell maintains control of the Senate, these voters will accept that. They will accept it. That is how democracy works. You know, lacking any actual evidence of something going horribly wrong or something not being fair. And, you know, a lot of people bring up Stacey Abrams, who, by the way, she is incredible. She is an incredible person, a rising star in America. Forget the political parties, but just somebody who gets it.
Oh, she's risen.
You know, I'm glad she wasn't elected governor, because she would just be in Trump's crosshairs now even more than she already is. Instead, he's attacking the person that he endorsed who won. It's hilarious to see. But Stacey Abrams has been an incredible person as far as getting the vote out. And people keep bringing up that she objected to the election when she was running for governor against Kemp, who was, he also happened to be the person in charge of the election, and he was running for governor, and he refused to step aside in one of those roles. She was not objecting to the results. She was objecting to the way the system shut people out. Big difference. Big difference. If you're objecting to something that is unfair, meaning that these people can't vote because you make it impossible for them to vote by adding on all kinds of unfair restrictions that don't apply to other people, or just making it something that is almost physically impossible for them to accomplish, that is a legitimate complaint, as it would be for any side. But as far as counting the numbers, no. No. She, along with everybody else, accepted the way the election turned out. What people objected to was accessibility, voter intimidation, disenfranchisement, all of that. And that's a part of democracy, is fixing things like that. So when you hear people on Fox News or any of those other crazy networks that are popping up, when you hear them say things like that, remember this context. There are facts. You can look this up. You can see for yourself what people said, what they did. And just because somebody says something is true does not make it true, no matter who they are. Now, if I know 3 million people have voted so far before today, which is incredible. And if they're on the Democratic side, it might be huge. Things in this country will change significantly if Democrats carry Georgia. Because even though the Senate is really, really close either way, but it would be 50-50, and Kamala Harris would be able to cast tie-breaking votes for those votes that require a simple majority, you wouldn't have the situation that we have had now for as long as I can remember. I mean, under Obama, Mitch McConnell was blocking everything left and right and making it impossible to actually do things. Well, I think Biden can get a lot done. I think he really understands a hell of a lot. He has been in Washington forever. He has friends on both sides of the aisle. He knows how to speak to people. He knows how to reach people. I don't think we can ask for more than unity, you know, in all the houses of Congress and in the streets. You're going to see attempts to tear all that apart tomorrow when Congress votes on the Electoral College. Trump today took Mike Pence out to lunch, or I don't know exactly how that works. It's basically trying to get him to do something that he doesn't have the power to do, because the rules mean nothing to Trump. The rules mean absolutely nothing to him. So he is trying to get Pence, and all of the people following Trump who believe everything he says is right, are castigating Mike Pence for not overturning the election when he doesn't have the power to do it in the first place. But, you know, I have no sympathy for him whatsoever, because he's been a yes man for the past however many years it's been. Feels like forever.
Go cry to mother.
What's that?
Go cry to mother.
Yes, he should go cry to mother. You're right. Probably is. I don't have sympathy. I am fascinated by the whole thing. Do we have popcorn for tomorrow?
No.
Oh, we're going to have to get some. Going to have to.
We'll try to find some. Maybe we can find some.
Drop boxes, which is very bad. You have Dropbox.
We're going to find popcorn before he finds these votes. You got to hurry up.
Our leaders, ladies and gentlemen.
We have affidavits from many people. I don't know if you saw the hearings, but you have drop boxes where the box was picked up and not delivered for 3 days. So all sorts of things
. Yes, it's time once again for our sustaining feature, Films of the Year That Was. It was the only way we could shut Trump up. Where we journey back into time and see an Academy Award winning film of every year that has ever happened when they had Academy Award winning films. We see both the domestic Academy Award winning film and the foreign Academy Award winning film. And we are up to, I believe, 1989. It's a little confusing because the ceremony takes place the year after, obviously. So the ceremony took place in 1990, but the film is from 1989. Is that right?
Well, I'll correct you, but you'll understand why in a second.
Uh-huh.
And just briefly before we get started, an aside, I don't want, without getting in too much details away personally, I want to just say that at this point I'm alive.
Oh, you mean you were born by the time
around
these films?
This general
well, actually,
vicinity.
you were alive for a while.
I've been around, yeah.
But you might have actually gone out to the theater and seen one of these films.
Well, that may come up in the next week or two. But just to point out, I in my memory, I remember this domestic Academy Best Picture Award winner for 1989, and that is, of course, Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, yes, Driving Miss Daisy. I don't know why I'm acting like I just remember we just saw the film. But the good film. Good film. I mean, you know, okay, pretty good. I have mixed feelings.
Yeah, weirdly in my, like, upbringing, it became, like, sort of a punchline for privilege, which is sort of a weird way to look at it and probably an incorrect reading of it. And I liked going back. But the plot is about, set in 1948, Daisy Werthmann, or Miss Daisy, a 72-year-old wealthy Jewish widowed retired school teacher, lives in Atlanta, Georgia, alone except for Adela, her housekeeper. She has a small accident leaving for a trip.
Small accident? She drove her car into her neighbor's yard and went over a retaining wall.
Okay, let's not get...
It's amazing nobody was killed. What if a child was back there?
She
highly irresponsible.
Hit the accelerator. She thought it was the brakes. Anyway, her son Bully, played by Dan Aykroyd.
Really good role for him.
Great role.
A dramatic role, but he did a... I remember I saw this film many years ago, and I was impressed by it then. I'm impressed by it now.
He hires Hoke Colburn, played by Morgan Freeman, an actor who needs no introduction.
Then we won't, but you didn't mention Jessica Tandy played Miss Daisy. Did you? I don't think you did.
I didn't say the actress. I did not say her name. Yes,
who was 81 years old when she played the role, and I think she won.
A 72-year-old. Yeah.
She played a 72-year-old, and at the end of the film, she's 97. So imagine somebody who is 81 having to age in a film. It's unusual, and I think she won the Best Actress, and I think it's the oldest person ever to win Best Actress or Actor. I think.
Yeah. Outstanding work, and it shows that really performance and abilities span human existence wherever you are on your own existence.
But what do you think of the film?
It was interesting. I liked the confluence. I think when I was younger, understand the confluence of religion, where they were positioned, and the subtle how some of that stuff was really subtle, and that's probably why as a young person. Or maybe not as aware a person even, you might, when you're watching this, look back and realize, wow, okay, there really are, like, social differences and a bunch of different things at play.
I didn't know Miss Daisy was Jewish.
I didn't know that either.
I forgot that.
Yeah.
And probably because she's a lot more Southern than she is Jewish. So
she's talking about, and, of course, Idella is
Esther Roll, Florida, from Good Times.
Presumed probably Baptist or Catholic or Christian in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're talking about other people in town who are, I don't know if it was Presbyterian or some other faith.
Episcopalians comes up, yes.
Yeah, that was it. She loved it.
How can you hang out with Episcopalians?
That's right. The way
honestly, I'm so ignorant. I don't know if I ever have known Episcopalians. I don't know if I'm Episcopalian. I don't know what that is.
Do you have commentary on what the Episcopalians are doing? I couldn't say what they're doing right
now. If somebody held a gun to my head right now and said, where's the nearest Episcopalian church? I would not be able to answer.
And yet, Miss Daisy had something to say. So, this story goes on, and Hoke becomes a really important part of Miss Daisy's life, and they become closer and closer. And again,
well,
as other things are subtle, that relationship burgeoning is also quite subtle.
It's a very gentle tale of the racist South. And for that, I didn't like it. I just felt angry because here you have Morgan Freeman as the driver of this racist old woman, basically kowtowing constantly, you know, doing whatever she says. But when you think of it, you know, a little more, and this is what I was saying before, was Miss Daisy a bad person? No, she wasn't. She was a good person, but that was the world that she was in at the time. Nobody played outside those boundaries, and she wasn't a nasty person. She had her prejudices, even though she claimed she didn't, and that was society. And she embraced the values of Martin Luther King as she grew older. So, you know, she was moving in the right direction. It just, it wasn't fast enough for me, but I know that's unrealistic.
Yeah, it shows that there is a requirement for a passage of time for individual scenarios and social groups and communities. I mean, even when they're traveling, there are moments when they're stopped by the police, and that the both of them together even shows that there are even more disparities and power and authority and institutions that are bearing down and weighing on their interaction with the world.
Now,
and
that's
the police.
That's a good example. The police basically at one point they're driving from Georgia to Alabama, which was a big deal back then. They didn't have interstates. And they stop at the side of the road and they're having lunch, and then these two cops just show up and start harassing Morgan Freeman, wondering how a black man is driving such a nice car. And these are not good people. Yeah, it's a racist time. Everybody's racist. I get it. But these are bad people because of the way they are treating him, the hostility, the hatred, the things they say, which I will not repeat as they're driving off. Whereas Miss Daisy was kind of a victim of her own time, you know, in much the same way that you could say your grandparents were, where they just had these conceptions of people because that's the way they were brought up. That was a society that reinforced that constantly. And I dare say people I grew up with, the same thing, you know, I would see this constantly. And I didn't speak up nearly enough against injustice as an 8-year-old or whatever. But the dialogue is going on inside your head. I don't know. It's a tough thing to be able to judge people based on the past. But I think you can say, in that time period, that's a good person, that's a bad person. So that's why I was kind of uneasy with the film, because it just seemed too gentle. But it did make me think. And I realized how much dignity and how much kindness Morgan Freeman demonstrated in his role. And I think it painted a pretty accurate picture of what happened.
Yeah, pride and dignity in his work and his place, his role. And he describes that in a couple lines, referencing his need for a job and her need for help and their reliance and mutual benefit mm-hmm. that could come from having that relationship. So I find it's difficult to criticize someone who's in that. It's someone who's lived a life of sort of missed opportunities. There's many things about the structures, like you're saying, of the time period that prevented her from seeing things from a different perspective, and those barriers, the representations that are warped in certain ways, build that anxiety and further that separation. So it makes me kind of that's a very sad thing mm-hmm. for people to grow around things that aren't necessarily true just because they haven't had the opportunity to experience and get to know others.
It was weird seeing Morgan Freeman get older, even though he wasn't that old then. And now, today, he looks the way he was made up to look back when that film was going towards its conclusion, when he was in his 70s. So it was. But the thing is, the role he played, yeah, he basically, he got it. He saw what was happening. At one point, he says to Miss Daisy, I guess I should use his name too, Hulk. That was the character he played. He was saying that, yeah, you think things are changing. They're not changing that much. because he's not satisfied with the pace, just like I'm not satisfied with the pace. And that is the life so many people were living back then.
That really is coming screaming back now when you see certain aspects of the Supreme Court changing, you know, when you hear or read about what's possible, decades of change going in a certain one direction or the other, socially or politically. That's really frightening, and I think those are also what we're going to be seeing with the runoffs and the results of the presidential and other outcomes.
Yeah, I should say, by the way, I meant to mention this earlier, but if you are one of our listeners in Georgia and you haven't yet voted, you have 18 minutes to vote, okay? Because
put on your shoes.
The polls close when our show ends. It always seems to happen that way. But yeah, it's weird also that this was taking place in Georgia. Georgia is in the headlines today. And, you know, one of the commentary tracks, and this film had a couple of different commentaries and features and things like that. I always like to watch those. But Atlanta in particular was seen as kind of this bastion against the darkness and hatred of the Deep South in that period. And I just, you know, I'm wondering, will Georgia be seen in that light after tonight? In many ways it already is. It's good to see, and we said this when we travel in the Deep South, it's good to see these points of light where people are basically living a positive life and being progressive and embracing other cultures and things like that and not sticking to the old ways of hatred and ignorance and the things that unfortunately the Deep South is has become associated with. Well, that doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to stay that way. You know, the Southern accent doesn't have to be equated with ignorance. I don't think it is. And I think it's wrong when you make those assumptions. And I think there are many people with Oxford accents that are idiots. But I could go on for a long time about that. Let's look at our international film.
Oh, you must be asking about the film. Now, this may throw you off, and I mentioned it earlier. This is from 1988, the Italian drama film by Giuseppe Tornatore.
Okay, you can say it that way if you want. 1988, yes, you're right. It was an extra year, but that's because it's further away. Yeah, I ordered a package in November from overseas, and it still hasn't gotten here. It's the same reason. All right, it takes longer for things over there to get over here. So that's why a film from 1988 won the 1989 Academy Award, which was announced in 1990.
Did you just, like, reduce space time to a DVD you ordered?
Okay, so what film is this?
Okay, here.
Keeping in mind that the clock is running.
1988, Rome. Famous director Salvatore Di Vida returns home.
Just read the damn title of the film.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't say that.
No.
Wow. I was just saying the director. No, it's Cinema Paradiso. And that's...
No, Paradiso, not Paradiso. There's not an I in there, is there? Paradiso. Cinema Paradiso.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. All this time, you're going around saying Cinema Paradiso.
Okay.
Different film.
You're right. It says Paradiso, not D-Z-O.
Interesting story. The first time I ever went to Europe in Amsterdam, it was the Paradiso where I basically met a whole bunch of hackers for the Galactic Hacker Party. Yeah, so that name means something to me. It's got nothing to do with this film, but I always think of that. So Cinema Paradiso, it's a really amazing film, favorites of so many people.
Yeah, and this guy returns home and finds that a guy from his past had died, and it brings these memories rushing back of who he was to him. And so the beginning of his return reminds him of his childhood, and you then are along for the ride of this, like, sort of chronicling of how he came to learn how to be a projectionist, essentially, at a Cinema Paradiso that Alfredo had basically taken him in as an understudy because he was a bit of a... Well, he would hang out at the theater.
Alfredo was the projectionist.
That's right. And he would basically sneak in, or he would find different ways to see what was going on, you know, find out, because a lot of the newsreels were coming out at the time. This is 48 again. right? Yes? No. Yeah, and around a little bit after World War II, 8-year-old is Salvatore.
Toto, as he's called in the film.
That's right. She is the son of a war widow.
Well, basically, he's a big shot director now. He gets a call. Well, he doesn't get a call from his mother. One of his girlfriends tells him that his mother's trying to reach him. Some guy named Alfredo has died, and they want him to go to the funeral, which is back in Sicily, and he's in Rome, which is basically a one-hour plane ride, as we find out later. And most of the film is a flashback. Most of the film is a flashback to his childhood and the pivotal moments that this theater basically encapsulated for him.
There's a fire, and it's on the account of safety film not being in vogue. In fact,
I didn't know film was flammable like that.
It predated safety film, and they actually show in the film later on as the theater gets a new projector that, see, look, the film isn't flammable anymore, but he causes a fire in his house because he had been bringing home little film clips from the cutting room because the priest would have him cut clips of kissing and that kind of stuff.
Okay,
out of the
yes,
film.
This is an interesting scene, and it happened many times. Basically, before the films were shown to the community, and it really is just one small town that has a theater. I guess in Italy there are tens of thousands of theaters, and basically the priest would come in before anyone else got to see the films and watch all these films, and he'd raise his hand whenever there was a scene that he objected to, which is usually somebody kissing, and the projectionist would actually have to go and physically cut that scene out, put it on the floor, and then put it back in when he returned the film later. And over the years, he managed to get quite a collection of those scenes that he didn't put back into the films.
At one point, Toto scolds him as like, "Hey, but you never put them back. You never send them back." And he got found out that he was taking these clips of whatever nudity or some removed scene that invariably just sat around the projection booth because it didn't get put back in.
I think he was the best part of the film. It's the kid, the Sicilian kid, that was just yelling back at the projectionist and giving him lip for everything that he did. But it really was, you felt like you were in that town. You felt like you were a part of it. There is basically a big fire, not one that the kid causes, but one that the projectionist causes. Because he's not watching the projector for a moment, and burns down the theater.
Well, he does something with reflecting light so people can see outside, but by reflecting the beam away from its traditional path towards the screen, he kind of disrupts it and I think maybe causes heat to go towards the open end of the projector instead of out into the room. So you see some interesting sort of physics cause an accident that you'd already seen sort of prelude to with Toto nearly burning his house.
Yes. So what do you think overall? Good film? Bad film?
Yeah, a good film. I think we saw this on a smaller TV, so both, of course, beautiful in widescreen or you know, modern prints of it. So in the comfort of our viewing in this series, it just... it kind of rang through. Like, I remembered a lot of what I'd seen. I think we saw it over the air.
It's weird. We remembered part of it and didn't remember other parts of it. So I'm trying to think, when did we see this? We must have seen it in passing on a TV channel somewhere, because there are parts I never saw before, but there are parts I remembered.
I feel like someone may have edited whatever aired version we saw.
Yeah. Any other comments on this film?
It's really kind of a neat location in Italy, of course, just some more period stuff, cars and lower budget, definitely lower budget than the sort of epic in Miss Daisy for that year.
I just like seeing all the people crowded into the theaters, and it made me think, that's what I want to do. When all this is over, I want to go back into crowded theaters, because I don't think we're ever going to actually lose the appeal for that. And it's funny to when he comes back for the funeral as a big-time director, They're about to tear down the theater and replace it with a parking lot, of all things, because nobody goes to the movies anymore. And keep in mind, this is, I guess, supposed to be contemporary times when it comes back, 1989. Basically, the reason given is, well, people now, they get videotapes and things like that. There's always a reason why theaters have to close down. But when you think, since 1989 up until now, theaters have still been there. People still want to go out to the movies. There's always a reason why there's going to be competition. But keep in mind, in Italy, there were a ton of theaters, tens of thousands, like I said. So maybe not as many theaters, but people still value that kind of thing. And I think people always will. And I think after this pandemic, people will still want to go to the theaters.
Yeah, as a communal sort of social activity, it's going to be hard to match it. And the versatility and constant addition of features and new aspect ratios and sound and interesting techniques they're able to capture drama or a documentary or whatever. I mean, the format itself is it's going to stay, and that both the experience and the latest in production value they're able to tell stories with will always, I think, have a place in one form, theater or another. It's a real difficult business right now, and with a lot of other performing arts, I really hope that they stick it out, because those institutions, those places, really do have a purpose in people's lives. That's a lot of time spent for people, and they're invested in and want to enjoy it.
And we should support them when we have the chance. All right, that's going to do it for films of the year that was. And next week, or when we get around to it, we'll have another couple of films to see. Is this still going on? Wow.
He stuffed the ballot boxes. They were stuffed like nobody's ever seen them stuffed before.
And another thing.
This guy's had too much to drink. This is somebody you 86... They're not allowed at this bar, and you call all the other bars on the street, and you tell them, look out for this guy. Don't let him in. He's had too much. He's causing trouble.
That's what the whole country will be saying soon.
His name is Barney.
Okay, so we have a couple minutes left. What happens after tomorrow? We have this insane rally in Washington, D.C., of people who believe that the election was fake, just like everything they don't like is fake. We have whatever results. I don't know if we'll know by tomorrow the results in Georgia. It's possible. I hear, you know, since it's not a whole country, and since it's only two races, they might be able to calculate it quicker. But that could change the mood of the people tomorrow in D.C.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure what it will take. I sure hope that people stay vigilant and really look out for your democracy. Look out for your voice. It's so critical to moving forward and taking care of one another.
Yeah, a story we didn't get a chance to really focus on was the tragedy, the horror in Kenosha, where Jacob Blake was shot last August. Today it was announced no charges against the police will be filed. You know, I can't say I'm surprised. I'm never surprised by this kind of thing. It's awful that people aren't surprised, but Wisconsin has mobilized the National Guard because they assume people are just going to cause mayhem. And maybe they should cause mayhem. Maybe that's the only way to be heard these days, when people can go into crowds and execute people and be bailed out as heroes. You know, that's what Kenosha taught us this summer. And The real threat to democracy is not people who are angry at injustice as far as having people executed in the streets. The real threat is basically people who believe that democracy doesn't work, and that an election with no problems, no reported fraud or anything like that, needs to be ignored because their guy didn't win. That's the problem. That's something that we have to be really worried about, and I think that's hopefully where we focus attention as far as basically keeping people from causing damage. Property damage is one thing, but damage to an institution that has held up for 250 years, that's something else, especially when it's being led by very, very powerful people. And you have to wonder, if they got their way, what kind of country would this be? Think about it. Think about Trump as a competent person, because I guarantee you the next Trump will be competent. He will learn, he or she will learn from everything that this clown has done wrong. Imagine, you see how easily people are swayed or manipulated. Imagine somebody who doesn't do the stupid things, but only does those things. And imagine somebody with a more militaristic bent. Hey, all the pins are set up, and the bowling ball is going to come down at some point. So it's up to us to figure out another part of that analogy to keep that from happening.
To be the bumpers. It keeps the ball roll. No, that doesn't really work.
I don't know
either.
What a bumper is.
Well, don't they have bumpers that put the, for the little kids and teach them how to bowl? You know, like so the ball doesn't go in the gutter and makes them feel like they hit something.
Regardless, we're gonna leave you. OTW@2600.com is our email address. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, argue for, against injustice. No matter how many people tell you, don't argue. They're wrong. Good night.
Burn your rose, no, don't argue!
Thanks for messing up my outro. That's what computers do. We'll see you next week. Good night.
I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.